friends, and welcome to this reading of the Ames Tribune for Friday, June 26th, 2020. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here's our first story. Story County Board of Health unanimously approves COVID-19 recommendations. This story is written by David Mullen. In wake of a current spike in coronavirus cases throughout Story County, the county's Board of Health unanimously approved the finalized version of their mitigation recommendations in an attempt to reduce the spread of the virus throughout the county. Prior to Thursday's meeting, Story County Board of Health Chair Dr. John Passion said, "The board received at least 10 emails from residents opposed to the board's recommendations." Lisa Heddins, a member of the county's Board of Supervisors and ex officio member of the Board of Health, will present these guidelines to the Story County Board of Supervisors in an upcoming meeting. "With the current rise in cases in Story County, we strongly recommend these guidelines are followed," said Passion during Thursday's meeting. "We fully understand that what we are proposing is difficult and also that no mitigation plan is foolproof. However, if those principles are followed, we can get and keep this virus under control until the availability of a vaccine." Passion added, "As a county board of health, our duties include the protection of public health of the residents of Story County. Our recommendations are made in light of what is best for the public's health, and we stand by our recommendations. The recommendations target multiple institutions such as businesses, social and religious gatherings, daycare centers, schools, and Iowa State University. Some of the recommendations that will be presented to the Story County Board of Supervisors include businesses to require all staff members to wear face coverings, hosts of large social or religious gatherings to assure attendees adhere to social distancing guidelines and wear face coverings throughout the event, teachers and daycare staff to wear face coverings and stagger lunch times, Iowa State University to enforce mitigation principles when off campus and when using mass transit. The board is also asking that each school, daycare, event, and religious gatherings take contactless temperatures of each participant. One of the larger recommendations includes requesting Iowa State University prohibit spectators at fall sporting events, including football games this year. However, despite these requests, Iowa University announced plans to fill Jack Trice Stadium. I think that should be Iowa State University. Announced plans to fill Jack Trice Stadium at 50% capacity on Wednesday. As guided by the governor, the CDC, the Iowa Department of Public Health, and other state and federal health experts, the current plan is for a 50% capacity limit for events at Jack Trice Stadium, including football. Additional mitigation strategies will be used to reduce the risk of COVID-19 spread, such as physical distancing, face coverings, electronic ticketing, and crowd management designed to reduce fan congestion and contact. That, according to Wendy Winterstein, talking through the university's website. While board members applauded Iowa State's efforts to enforce face coverings worn by all students and faculty members, board members do not agree with the university's decision on sporting events. "I think it is a terribly wrong decision to allow fans to spectate major sporting events this fall," Passion told the Tribune. "The U.S. CDC and Prevention would classify a football game as the highest risk event that could be held and spread the disease." The university put out a statement about how they care about the community and they want to be members of the community. If they're true to their word, they need to cancel spectators at fall sports. If they don't, that just says that their document that they put out isn't true and that they don't care a rip about us. On Monday, members of the Story County Board of Health said that they believe large events, such as football games, will not be safe to the public. "We cannot think of any way these events can be made even remotely safe with the masses of people from throughout Iowa and other states who routinely attend these events. Please do it for the health of our community," Passion said during the board meeting on Monday. On Thursday, health officials reported an additional 29 cases of COVID-19 throughout Story County. Since the beginning of March, nearly 450 cases have been reported within Story County as cases and hospitalizations throughout the state began to decline. We were doing really well in Story County until June 1st or 2nd, and we can get there again, Passion told the Tribune. If we follow these guidelines, we can get this virus under control until the vaccine is released. And although Governor Reynolds extended the emergency proclamation order for another 30 days on Thursday, which alters the level of enforcement the board has, but Passion says at least their guidelines are out there for the public. One thing we learn as a physician is all we really give is advice, and if they don't take it, they don't take it, Passion told the Tribune. But they can never say that they were not told. Our next story from the front page of the Tribune. Ames Black Lives Matter demands change during a march for justice. This story written by Kylie Mullen. More than 200 civil rights protesters marched across downtown Ames on Wednesday evening, demanding local and national change in how communities are policed. The group, led by Ames Black Lives Matter organization during its March for Justice event, demanded local government officials reduce the Ames Police Department's budget and create a Citizens Police Review Board, among other items. The march kicked off at Ames Banshell Park and moved west along the street of Lincoln Way before gathering at the intersection of Lincoln Way and Grand Avenue. Protesters held up signs, some of which read, "The people are rising," "White silence is violence," "Legalize being black," and "Black Lives Matter." They also chanted phrases such as "No justice, no peace," and "The people united will never be divided," as they continued the march north on Grand Avenue and moved towards Ames City Hall. It was here that organizers listed demands they have for Ames government, which included reducing the Ames Police Department's budget to $25 million annually, and ensuring the department's budget does not account for more than 10% of the city's budget in any fiscal years to come. Reducing any funds over the 10% towards mental health services, drug treatment and addiction prevention, low income and affordable housing, before and after school programs, parks and recreation, and public transit. Providing a full publication of Ames' annual budget and a working plan to move the Ames police towards community policing, divesting from and removing all military-grade equipment, and ending contracts with the federal government. Decriminalizing the use and possession of marijuana less than 40 grams. Creating a Citizens Police Review Board with the ability to subpoena, enact, and enforce measurable consequences when board recommendations are not followed or implemented. And fire and remove officers. Ensuring every city department has at least 30% of its staff dedicated to diversity and inclusion. It is important that we keep moving toward progress and that we don't let anything stop us until we get what we want. And what we want is equity, and what we want is to be on the same playing field as the people around us, an organizer said to the gathered crowd. Another organizer also demanded a building named in honor of suffragist Carrie Chapman Catz on Iowa State University's campus be renamed, citing a highly disputed allegation that she once embraced white supremacy. This demand echoed those made during the Ames Black Lives Matter First protest, which took place on campus last week. Catz Hall is named after Carrie Chapman Catz, and she was a white supremacist. "We don't want that at Iowa State University's campus," the organizer said. "She's classist, xenophobic, racist, and that does not represent us as a community." While protesters spoke about their experiences with racism and police brutality and discussed the change they wanted to see within the Ames community and at Iowa State University, City Councilman Tim Garten watched from the back of the crowd. When a protester called on him to address the group, he said, "I am just here to listen. On behalf of the City Council, we have been working on issues of racial justice for a number of years," he said, when pushed to speak. "Our Ames Police Department has been working hard to involve in the community and community policing, and I am very proud of what we have done. I have personally been involved with our local Ames NAACP chapter for the last 5 years, trying to listen and understand. So I did not come here tonight to speak, I came here to listen. When protesters asked Garton to pledge his agreement to the Ames Black Lives Matter listed demands, while chanting yes or no, Garton refused. Yes or no, it's that simple. No sentences outside of that, a protester told Garton. Then I'm not here to answer, Garton said. Protesters responded by demanding Garton leave, and when he would not remove himself from the crowd, they resumed marching. Once protesters concluded the march at Banshell Park, organizers announced Garton had agreed to contact the organization to set up a meeting with the council, and if that doesn't happen, we will hold him accountable. Whether a meeting has been arranged was unclear as of Thursday evening, but Garton posted on Facebook following the event, "The crowd was frustrated with me because I would not agree on the spot to all of the demands. I hope to meet with the organizers, even if I can't support all of the demands. I hope we can understand the concepts underlying the demands and find common ground," the post read. Attempts to contact both Garton and the Ames Black Lives Matter organization on Thursday were unsuccessful. Our next article, a protest update, Minneapolis City Council to vote on abolishing police. Elijah McClain's death investigation is reopened. This story comes to us from USA Today, and it was posted at 12 noon on Friday. The Minneapolis City Council took a first step Friday towards abolishing the city's police department, a move protesters have repeatedly called for during the month since George Floyd was killed as one of the city's officers kneeled on his neck. Nationally, the House passed its own police reform package that would end certain legal protections for officers accused of misconduct and ban chokeholds. The legislation now moves to the Senate. Meanwhile, protests continue around the United States, including in Kentucky, where social justice groups continue to demand the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death be arrested. In Seattle, some protesters in the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or Capitol Hill Organized Protest, said they will stay despite the mayor's plan to wind down the zone. There was also a standoff between protesters and authorities at the Emancipation Memorial in Washington, D.C. on Thursday. Protesters had vowed to tear down the statue, but law enforcement responded with police presence and fences to protect the statue featuring Abraham Lincoln. The Minneapolis City Council on Friday unanimously approved a radical proposal to change the city's charter that would allow the police department to be dismantled following mass public criticism of law enforcement over the killing of George Floyd. The 12-0 vote is just the first step in a process that faces significant bureaucratic obstacles to make the November ballot, where the city's voters will have the final say. Doing so would first require amending the city charter. Draft language of the amendment posted online would replace the department with a Department of Community Safety and Violence Prevention, which will have responsibility for public safety services, prioritizing a holistic public health-oriented approach. It also provides for a division of licensed peace officers who would answer to the department's director. "It is time to make structural change," Council Member Steve Fletcher said. "It is time to start from scratch and reinvent what public safety looks like." The amendment now goes to a policy committee and to the city's charter commission for formal review. Activist and cousin of the late Muhammad Ali, Sean Ali Waddell Jr., joined more than 500 protesters, including hip-hop star Common, actress Jada Pinkett Smith, and rapper Rhapsody, at a Kentucky Capitol rally on Thursday calling for racial justice in the wake of Breonna Taylor's death. Taylor was fatally shot by Louisville police in her own apartment in March. "I will stand up for and with black women until my last breath," Common said in a poem he wrote about Taylor. Meanwhile, Waddell, warned the Kentucky Attorney General to avoid being on the wrong side of history. Attorney General Daniel Cameron has been charged with investigating the officers involved in Taylor's shooting. A whole bunch of people, white folks, people that don't stand up for us, love to treat us like items, love to treat us in cases on the wall, Waddell said. If Ali was alive, Waddell proclaimed, he would tell McConnell, take my damn name off the wall if you're not gonna stand for my people. Mandy McLaurin, Teresa Duval, and Emma Austin apparently contributed to that story. After an online petition gained more than 3 million signatures, Colorado Governor Jared Polis signed an executive order appointing Attorney General Phil Weiser to re-examine the death of Elijah McClain, who is a 23-year-old black man who died in police custody last year in Colorado. The news comes after Polis signed a sweeping police accountability bill last week that bars the use of chokeholds and cartoid holds. McClain, a massage therapist who enjoyed playing the violin, was walking home from a convenience store in 2019 when he was apprehended by Aurora, Colorado police officers after they received a call reporting a suspicious man wearing a ski mask, according to a release. Officers said McClain was actively resisting arrest and trying to grab one of their guns, the police officer's guns, when they wrestled him to the ground and performed a cartoid hold. McClain was later injected with a ketamine to sedate him. In the more than 3 hours of body camera footage of the arrest, McClain could be seen being held down on the ground, briefly unconscious, vomiting, sobbing, and saying, I can't breathe. At one point, an officer tells McClain, if you keep messing around, I'm going to bring my dog out and he's going to bite you. McClain was loaded into the ambulance, where paramedics determined he was not breathing and did not have a pulse. He was declared brain dead 3 days later and was removed from life support on August 30th. The Tucson, Arizona city manager rejected police chief Chris Magnus's offer to resign during a press conference Wednesday after a video of a man's death in police custody in April was released to the public. All facets of the case have been and continue to be investigated, Councilmember Stephen Kozachik said in the statement reporting the decision. The reality is that Chief Magnus has both supported and, in fact, initiated those internal reviews. He is to be commended for that transparency and willingness to hold police accountable. The video released Wednesday showed Tucson resident Carlos Adrian Ingram Lopez restrained by police, lying face down, and wheezing for 12 minutes until he was no longer responsive on April 21st. In this moment, my focus is on the fact that the life of a fellow Tucsonian, Carlos Adrian Ingram Lopez, was needlessly lost, Mayor Regina Romero said in a statement, who also said Thursday that she does not believe Magnus should resign. Jenna Marbles, a longtime YouTuber with more than 20 million subscribers, says she is quitting YouTube. In a video posted on Thursday, Marbles, whose real name is Jenna More, who is 33, said she has made many of her old videos private and that she is going to move on from her channel. Marbles apologized for a 2011 video in which she impersonated Nikki Manage, saying it was not her intention to do blackface. She continued, it is shameful, it is awful, I wish it wasn't part of my past. She addressed another 2011 video in which she makes a joke about Asians, which she calls awful and inexcusable, and an additional 2012 video that came across unbelievably slut-shamey, she said. She also apologized for past videos in which she makes jokes about gender stereotypes, making the videos private. Marble said she is unsure if she will be stepping down temporarily or permanently. I just want to make sure that things I'm putting onto the world are not hurting anyone. I'm just going to stop for now or forever, she said. I don't know. The Minneapolis City Council is expected to approve a proposal Friday that could lead to amending the city's charter and the elimination of its police department, a radical move coming in the wake of the death of George Floyd. While a majority of the council supports abolishing the department, the vote on Friday is the first step in a longer bureaucratic process, and the decision would ultimately need to be okayed by voters in November. Other city officials, including Mayor Jacob Frey, have pushed back against the proposal. Draft language of the proposed amendment posted online would replace police with a Department of Community Safety and Violence Prevention, which will have responsibility for public safety services, prioritizing a holistic public health oriented approach. A former Miami Gardens police officer is facing battery and misconduct charges in Florida after a video surfaced of him putting his knee into a black woman's neck and tasing her stomach, local media reported. Jordy Yanes Martel, who was fired last week along with another officer, was arrested on Thursday, the Miami Herald reported. In January, the officer was off duty and working security at a strip club when Safaya Sachel got into an argument with the manager and was asked to leave, the newspaper reported. Martel and another security guard then approached Sachel and a friend who were in their car, and Martel told her to get out of her vehicle so he could issue her a trespassing warning, the Herald reported. Sachel asked if she could drive to Martel's car because she wasn't wearing shoes, but Martel told her to get your shoes on and come with me, the newspaper reported. Authorities said at a press conference that Martel then forcibly reached into the woman's car, pulled her out, knelt on her neck, and tased her twice in the stomach. Martel allegedly filed a police report with false information as well, saying that the woman was resisting arrest. Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rendell said. During a press conference Thursday, a new group of black leaders at Seattle's Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone said protesters will decide how long to stay in the area, despite the mayor's plan to dismantle the zone, the Seattle Times reported. If the people of Seattle choose to hold the space at CHOP, Black Collective Voices will stay here, said Nadia Miller, leader of the Black Collective Voices, said. On Monday, Mayor Jenny Durkan announced the city will wind down the block's long area in the wake of several shootings this past weekend. It's time for people to go home, Durkan said. Activists have occupied the area since June 8. Miller said that even if protesters are forced out of the area, it will not stop us or this movement, she said. We will not be bought off. We will not attend meetings where the goal is to buy us off. We are here to dismantle systemic racism. Protesters in Washington, D.C. vowed to take down the Emancipation Memorial on Thursday, but an increased police presence resulted in a standoff between the sides. The statue in Lincoln Park shows President Abraham Lincoln kneeling over a freed slave to illustrate the Emancipation Proclamation. The memorial was paid for by former slaves and dedicated by Frederick Douglass. Delaware, Del Eleanor Holmes Norton, a Democrat from the District of Columbia, is among those who say the statue should come down, saying that those who designed it didn't take into account the views of African Americans. The House panel, a sweeping police reform package on Thursday, the House passed a sweeping police reform package on Thursday that would end certain legal protections for officers accused of misconduct and ban chokeholds in response to the death of George Floyd, who was killed after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. The 236 to 181 vote, largely along party lines, comes one day after Democrats blocked the Senate from moving forward on a competing bill due to arguments the legislation did not go far enough to enacting meaningful changes demanded by protesters in dozens of cities across the country. Three Republicans, Representatives Will Hurd, Brian Fitzpatrick, and Fred Upton, joined the Democrats in voting in favor of the measure. The House bill, which was crafted by the Congressional Black Caucus, aims to bolster police accountability and end the practice of aggressive officers moving from one department to another by creating a national registry to track those with checkered records. It also would end certain police practices, such as the use of no-knock warrants and chokeholds, which have been under scrutiny after the recent deaths of Black Americans. Amid a national push to rethink racist stereotypes in popular culture, Disney is giving its Splash Mountain attraction a new theme based on its 2009 film, The Princess and the Frog. It's centered on Disney's first Black princess. The move follows a Change.org petition calling for Disney to drop the original inspiration for Splash Mountain, the 1946 film Song of the South, according to Disney. The company has been working on the change since last year. The film was controversial from the beginning for what its critics included, including the NAACP, considered a glossed over portrayal of slavery. Its live-action narrator, an elderly Black man named Uncle Remus, was played by James Baskett, who was the second African-American to win an Oscar. Baskett did not attend the film's premiere at an Atlanta theater, where Blacks had to sit separately in the balcony. The Philadelphia, Pennsylvania City Council Thursday adopted a series of police reform bills, had oversight in the police department, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported. The bill requires police officers to have lived in Philadelphia for at least 1 year prior to hiring. The bill is aimed at increasing diversity among police force, Councilmember Shirley L. Parker said to the Inquirer. The people policing the city of Philadelphia should look like the city of Philadelphia, she said. Also at the meeting, the city council approved a budget reducing funding to the police department by $33 million. The budget also called for increasing body-worn cameras and engaging mental health professionals for police-assisted diversion, according to the Inquirer. The passage of the bills comes after Philadelphia police used tear gas on protesters in the early days of the protest and after they detained at least 20 protesters occupying a government building. City and state governments that allow autonomous zones such as the Capitol Hill organize protests in Seattle would lose federal funding under a bill put forward by Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa. Her bill comes after a North Carolina Republican introduced a similar proposal in the House of Representatives earlier this week. Mayors and city leaders are letting this chaos and anarchy continue in their streets, and in some cases preventing law enforcement from doing their job, Ernst said Thursday morning on a conference call with Iowa reporters. That is not the America I know or fought for. Ernst's bill is primarily a response to the Senate Autonomous Zone formed in early June after police abandoned a local precinct following nights of protests. I'm sorry, that was the Seattle Autonomous Zone, not the Senate Autonomous Zone. After police left, protesters sectioned off several city blocks and named the area the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ, saying it would be free of police. They have since renamed the zone as CHOP for Capitol Hill Organized Protest. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. U.S. Army Lieutenant retired Herbert Duane Strasser, age 71, of Oskaloosa, passed away on Wednesday, June 24th, at Serenity Hospice House of Oskaloosa after a courageous battle against pancreatic cancer. Herbert was born November 29, 1948 in Oskaloosa, Iowa, to Howard G. Swade Strasser and Darlene M. Heemstra Strasser. He was raised on the family farm north of Rose Hill and graduated from Oskaloosa High School in 1967. Herbert earned his bachelor's degree in agriculture education from Iowa State University in 1971, a master's degree in adult vocational counseling from Kansas State in 1977, and his PhD in educational leadership from Iowa State University in 1999. Herbert married Margaret I. Jackson, his high school sweetheart, on November 28, 1969, while they were both students at Iowa State University. After graduation, Herer was commissioned as an officer in the United States Army. They began a career as a military family that lived in locations all over the United States and in Europe, and they raised sons, Hale and Eric. During Herbert's military career, he was a logistics officer and a helicopter maintenance test pilot, aviation company commander, and the inspector general of the 101st Airborne Division during the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. He also taught Army ROTC and served as the professor of military science for the Iowa State University Army ROTC. Herbert's military awards included a Bronze Star, Southwest Asia Service Medal, and with two Bronze Stars, Kuwait Liberation Medal, Jump Wings, Senior Army Aviation Badge, Aviator Badge, and Air Assault Badge. After serving on active duty in the United States Army for 23 years, Herbert retired from the military as a Lieutenant Colonel. In his civilian life, Herbert went on to serve as the assistant to the Vice Provost for Iowa State University Extension for 4 years. As he worked toward completion of his PhD, Herbert served on the Ames Community School Board from 1994 to 1997. He later transitioned to be Northeast Hamilton High School's curriculum director and the vocational agriculture teacher in Blairsburg, Iowa. After 12 years of teaching at Northeast Hamilton, Herbert retired again. Even after his formal retirement from education, Herbert briefly continued to teach ag-related courses at Ellsworth Community College. Herbert and Margaret moved back to Oskaloosa in 2015. They celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary with family and friends just this last fall. In recent years, Herbert enjoyed volunteering at the Well Pella Serenity Hospice House and the Nelson Pioneer Farm. He also loved restoring furniture, creating woodworking and crafting projects, gardening, landscaping, and planting trees as a master gardener, attending auctions, teaching others, and spending time with his family. Through his involvement in Boy Scouts of America, Herbert was a scoutmaster. He served on the district committee in the Mid-Iowa Council Boy Scouts of America, and he earned the Silver Beaver Award. Herbert was a member of the Knights of Pytha Montezuma. Herbert loved both to learn and teach. He had a knack of inspiring others and possessed the knowledge and the charisma to lead others toward success. Herbert is survived by his bride, Margaret, his son, Hale, Corey of Johnston, Iowa, his son, Eric, and Melissa of Gilberts, Illinois, and Umberto and Doris Jones of Detroit, Michigan, who was like a son to him. Grandchildren are Harrison, Eric, Sean, Jason, Hannah, Umberto, Antonio, and Gabriella. Herbert leaves behind many nieces, nephews, friends, and other relatives. He was preceded in death by his parents. As was Herbert's wish, his body has been cremated. A burial family memorial service will be held at a later date. Burial of the urn with military honors by members of the Oskaloosa American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars will be in the Wymore Cemetery near Rose Hill. The Bates Funeral Chapel is in charge of the arrangements. Open visitation will be Friday, July 10, after 11 o'clock in the morning in the Bates Funeral Chapel, and the family will be at the funeral chapel from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, July 10th. To greet friends and relatives. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Nelson Pioneer Farm and Museum. Please mail all cards and memorials to Post Office Box 207, Oskaloosa, Iowa 52577. And here's an opinion piece from the Tribune. It's written by Chloe Valderi. She is a writer and founder of Theory of Enchantment, a New York-based company that teaches social and emotional learning, anti-racism, and diversity and inclusion in high schools and companies and government agencies. It is titled, "As Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, in order to confront racism, we first must find the strength to love." As protesters in Gulf America, we find ourselves at a crossroads. The brutal death of George Floyd at the hands of police officer Derek Chauvin ignited a fire in the soul of a beleaguered nation, ravished by months of isolation, surging unemployment, and more than 100,000 deaths from COVID-19. Now, we're in a panic to do the work of racial justice. Celebrities have tweeted their outrage. Corporations have posted Black Lives Matter statements on social media. And some have pushed for diversity, equality, and inclusion initiatives that claim to promote anti-racist ideals in the workplace. This attempt to correct injustice is laudable, but the work of anti-racism must be rooted in the moral ethic of love and acknowledge the profound sacredness of human beings. Love is not empty sentimentalism. Martin Luther King Jr. warned against such thinking in his seminal work, Strength to Love, in 1963. King argued love could transform hearts and minds as it reflected the idea God's image is indelibly etched in everyone. Coretta Scott King explained, by reaching into and beyond ourselves and tapping the transcendental moral ethic of love, we shall overcome all evils. But how do we practice love? The answer lies in honoring what it fundamentally means to be human. All humans have the capacity to do good and evil, to treat each other and ourselves with cruelty and malice, or with compassion and care. Pulitzer Prize-winning artist Kendrick Lamar demonstrated this complexity in his lyrics, "I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA." We all have this duality within us, and we are capable of being both the oppressor and the oppressed, the freedom fighter and the fascist, regardless of our skin color or our situation in life. To humanize a person is to treat them in a way that honors this complexity. Dehumanization occurs when we ignore this complexity and caricature each other as pure monsters or pure angels. To see a human being like this is not to see him at all. The film Beauty and the Beast warns us against this, and it's worth studying, since Disney has connected Americans of many different backgrounds, experiences, and perspectives through a shared set of stories and narratives. In that film, a vain prince is cursed because he prejudges others based on their physical appearance. He is physically transformed into the thing he despises, a macabre and cruel beast. Still, the townspeople who become so eager to kill the beast are also corrupt. Just because the beast has behaved badly doesn't mean the people are justified in becoming overzealous and tyrannical in their pursuit of justice. The only force that can reverse this is someone who has the foresight to look beyond the physical appearances and understand intuitively that a human being is, in the words of Ralph Ellison, the sensitively focused process of opposites, of good and evil, of instinct and intellect, of passion and spirituality, which great literary art has projected as the image of man. Belle is heroic because of her capacity to perceive the redeemable man even within the monster, and to treat him as such. As a nation, we have failed to live up to this ideal. We see each other not as multifaceted, woefully imperfect beings, but as beasts and objects of worthy contempt, or as worthy of contempt. In our politics and on social media, we reduce each other to political abstractions and dehumanize one another regularly. In his 2008 speech, A More Perfect Union, Barack Obama noted this was not the way. Instead, black and white Americans need to pursue justice with the understanding that our destinies are intertwined. For the African American community, that path means embracing the burdens of our past without becoming victims of our past. Binding our particular grievances for better health care and better schools and better jobs to the larger aspirations of all Americans, the white woman struggling to break the glass ceiling, the white man who has been laid off, the immigrant trying to feed his family. And it means taking full responsibility for our own lives by demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children, reading to them and teaching them that while they face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. They must always believe that they can write their own destiny. And likewise for whites, Obama noted that the path to a more perfect union means acknowledging that what ails the African-American community does not just exist in the minds of black people, that the legacy of discrimination and current incidents of discrimination, while less overt than in the past, are real and must be addressed, not just with words, but with deeds, by investing in our schools and our communities, by enforcing our civil rights laws and ensuring fairness in our criminal justice system, by providing this generation with ladders of opportunity that were unavailable for previous generations. Despite our hardships, can we find the courage to hold fast to the impenetrable idea of liberty and justice for all? Learn to go the extra mile for our neighbor and recommit ourselves to each other's welfare and to this project we call America. Will we push for our policies that reflect the spirit of democracy, that seek out the well-being of all, black and white, civilian and police officer, poor and rich, conservative and liberal? Will we develop the inner conviction to have compassion for each other this fiercely, in spite of our tribal brawls and bickering? Will we gather the strength to love? And here's another opinion piece from the Tribune. It's titled History in the Remaking. It's written by Rick Holmes. America's reckoning with historic memory has taken some stranger turns in this season of disease and discontent. Monuments long ignored are falling every day, mostly for good reasons, though some of it has been messy. Confederates are in retreat across the map. Statues of Confederate leaders are being dismantled, mostly on the orders of local officials whose constituents no longer want to celebrate the champions of a white supremacist rebellion. Portraits of four former House speakers who served the Confederacy were just exiled from the United States Capitol. The Confederate battle flag has been banned from NASCAR events, and Walmart stores in Mississippi are refusing to fly the state flag because it includes the Confederate stars and bars. The Confederate's ideological soulmates are joining them in exile. The lost cause historians have been sent packing. It's a new day, especially in the South. Confederates aren't the only ones taking a beating. Columbus was decapitated in Boston and will be dismantled in Philadelphia. A statue of Juan de Ornate, a particularly nasty conquistador, is being removed in Albuquerque. Protesters are coming after Andrew Jackson, who, to be honest, deserves it. People are taking a fresh look at statues that have gone unnoticed for decades. They are questioning the individuals the monuments exalt, the events they celebrate, the cultural and the historical context in which they were erected, the aesthetics of the statuary. American history teachers and art historians must be thrilled. For some monuments, the problem isn't the subject, but the presentation. A statue of Theodore Roosevelt in New York is being removed because Teddy Roosevelt's placement on a horse makes the figures walking alongside, a Native American and a black man, look subservient. The Freedman's Memorial in Washington was built with money donated by former slaves, dedicated in 1876 with a speech by Frederick Douglass. It honors Abraham Lincoln and celebrates emancipation. But the pose, Lincoln standing over a black man, rising from his knees, while common in abolitionist imagery, is uncomfortable to some modern eyes. Evaluating each monument is history, message, and aesthetics can be tricky. Communities that do it right empanel committees. They consult with historians. They listen to activists and community members. They weigh alternatives. Elected officials make the decisions, and courts consider legal challenges. The result isn't just the removal of a statue. It's a sharpened understanding of the community's historic record and contemporary values. That's how democracy is supposed to work, by giving everyone a voice. Then again, you could skip the boring democratic procedures and use chains to tear the statues down. That's how a tiny minority of impatient activists or provocateurs are expressing themselves. In Philadelphia, someone defaced the statue of abolitionist Matthias Baldwin. In Madison, Wisconsin, a breakaway group that first told peaceful protesters to go home toppled the statue of abolitionist Hans Christian Hake, who died fighting for the Union. In San Francisco, where tributes to the Confederacy are hard to find, a mob toppled a bust of Ulysses S. Grant, who defeated the Confederate armies, suppressed the first Ku Klux Klan, and got the 15th Amendment guaranteeing voting rights for all put into the Constitution. Who decided U.S. Grant must be toppled from his perch? How representative were they of the communities on whose behalf they chose to act? Where was the discussion of Grant's life and his legacy, of the origin, the context, and the meaning of the statue in Golden Gate Park? Even anarchist collectives give all members a chance to speak before deciding what to order for breakfast or what to blow up. Where was the vote to tear down the statue of a hero in America's struggle for racial justice? Regrettable and undemocratic, to be sure, but every party needs a fringe and every movement has a vanguard. We must not let the rhetoric and the tactics of extremists distract from what's really happening here. America is coming to grips with its history and a seriousness we haven't seen in 50 years. This focus on America's history of racism, violence, and injustice is a sign that the movement we're seeing is deeper than calls for police reform. The breadth of the protests seen in every state, in small towns, as well as big cities, points to a turning of the tide. The diversity of the people who have taken to the streets. Black Lives Matter being shouted by Americans of every race, every age, every background, and polls showing they are supported by a strong majority of voters make this a historic moment. The Reverend William J. Barber, a grassroots leader based in North Carolina, calls it the Third Reconstruction. Like the first two Reconstructionists, the Civil War era and the Civil Rights era, this was a fusion moment powered by people of all races and backgrounds, building a more righteous future together. If we are willing to see ourselves as we are and have been, Barber writes, we will also see our potential for prophetic resistance, even in times like these. In Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, people have for years called for a huge statue of Robert E. Lee to be taken down. City officials supported the change, but the state legislature blocked them. But in the last few years, Democrats have taken over the governor's office, and the legislature, which enacted a new law giving municipalities authority over such decisions. But something interesting is happening on Lee Circle. While Virginians wait for the courts to make way for the deconstruction crews, over the last 6 weeks, Lee's statue has become a gathering spot for Black Lives Matter protesters. Its stone pedestal has become a canvas for graffiti artists. At night, images of African-American heroes are projected onto its surfaces. It has become a site for music and dance, conversation and selfies, an ongoing celebration of Black lives. It's enough to make old Bobby Lee fall off his horse in amazement. And it's another sign of history in the making, or the remaking. Rick Holmes can be reached if you want to write to him at rick@rickholmes.net. You can like him on Facebook if you wish, at Holmes & Company, or you can follow him on Twitter at Holmes & Company. In our next story, I'm leaving and I'm just not coming back. Fed up with racism, Black Americans head overseas. This story is written by Kim Helmgard, who writes for USA Today. Anthony Baguette knew the precise moment he had to get out. He was driving by a convenience store in Cincinnati when a police officer pulled him over. There had been a robbery. He fit the description given by the store's clerk, a Black man. Owena Kadabi Kamon knew. He was arrested in Chicago and was accused by police of concealing a loaded gun under a seat in his car. He did have a gun, but it was not loaded. He used it in his role teaching at an outdoor skills camp for inner-city kids. Kamon also had a license. The gun was kept safely in the car's trunk. Tiffany Grayton knew. Her family kept getting priced out of gentrifying neighborhoods in New Jersey. She felt they were destined to be forever displaced in the United States. Then Trayvon Martin was shot and killed after buying a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea. Baguette lives in Germany now, Trayton in Trinidad, and Tobago Cambon in Guyana. All three are part of a small cultural cohort, black emigres who, feeling cornered and powerless in the face of persistent racism, police brutality, and economic struggles in the United States of America, have chosen to settle and pursue their American-born dreams abroad. No official statistics cover these international transplants. In Guyana, where Cambon is involved in a program that encourages descendants of the African diaspora to return to a nation where centuries earlier their ancestors were forced into slave ships, he says he is one of several thousand. Cambon rejects descriptors such as Black American or African American that identify him with the United States of America. In Trinidad and Tobago, where Drayton now works in her home office with a view of the ocean and hummingbirds frolicking above the pool, there are at least four: Drayton, her mother, her sister, and her sister's boyfriend. There are likely more. About 120,000 Americans live in Germany, which is home to an estimated 1 million people of African descent. But because, for historical reasons, Germany's census does not use race as a category, it is not possible to calculate how many hail from the United States. "There's a lot of institutional racism in Germany," said Baguette, who is 68, who has lived in Berlin for more than 30 years. Years later, Baguette feels conflicted about his move. He described the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 as a time when neo-Nazis and skinheads would throw black people all off the S-Bahn, the city's subway system. "But I still felt, and I feel better off here and safer," he said. In interviews with more than a dozen expatriate black Americans spread out across the globe, from the Caribbean to West Africa, it became clear that for some, the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis has proved fresh evidence that living outside the United States can be an exercise in self-preservation. In 2019 study by the National Academy of Sciences, it found that black men were around 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police. A 2020 analysis of 100 million traffic stops conducted across the country determined that black people were far more likely to be pulled over by police than white people. But that difference narrows significantly at night, when it is harder to see dark skin. Black Americans face a far higher risk of being arrested for petty crimes. They account for 1/3 of the prison population, but just 13% of the overall population, according to Pew Research, a nonpartisan fact tank. Grayton, who is 28, is writing a book about fleeing from racism in America. She said one of the starkest illustrations of how her life has changed since moving to Trinidad and Tobago in 2013 is how she feels comfortable driving her kids around the block, to get them to sleep each night without being worried about what happens if she is pulled over by the police. "In America, your hands are shaking. You're worried about what to say. You're worried about whether you have the right identification. You're just so worried all the time," she said of the interactions her friends experience regularly with American police officers. For other black Americans who have chosen what amounts to a form of foreign exile, Floyd's death and the ensuing social justice protests that erupted in its wake, they have confirmed prior realizations. Leaving may not mean a life completely free from racism and police brutality, but it is at least feeling somewhat more within reach. "It wasn't until I left the United States to experience Spain that I really got a sense of what freedom looks like. I was able to be 100% myself, without having to worry about safety and without needing to have too much of a complex identity, said Brooklyn, New York native Saina Brown, who's 28 and lives near Valencia on the Mediterranean Sea. Brown has found a company that helps Black American women emigrate to Spain. She said Spain isn't racism-free and it isn't that diverse, but she has experienced it as a welcoming place where people are willing to be educated about their prejudices. You have been listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS.